Penguin Random House Canada presents In the Upper Country by Kai Thomas. Read for you by Tamika Tafari, Milton Barnes, and Wesley French. Prologue. A pirate on the inland sea took me south. "It's a thing to behold," he told me. In truth, I hadn't seen free country till I saw that. "You been to Colored Church before?" "Yes." "But has your grain known a Negro grist mill?" "No." "Not unless you been there. The ironmasters, the school teachers, even the dogs, all colored. And the runaways flood in like spring and summer rains. Hobbling, mind you, running, holding their wounds, blood in their eyes. There in New Canaan or Dunmore, Buxton, or up in the Queen's Bush. There to rest their cracked feet, heal unseamed wounds. They have time there, at long last, doctoring sometimes, but mostly just time, and bush-wild medicine from a hand like yours. And once healed, I tell you, in those towns they have a grace in the way they walk, like they know for certain that they reached where they meant to reach. If I would be an honest man, the pirate said to me, I'd make my life in such country. Glory and the promised land, no? I'm sure I scoffed. Even then, I'd seen enough to know that behind every glorious thing is a whole mess of trouble. Chapter 1. Dunmore, July, 1859. It was dusk, and I muttered curses to myself as I made my way down the muddy green lane. Just minutes earlier, it seemed, I'd been tired and keen to finish my day with some stew and warm bread. Some idle chit-chat in the rocking chair, perhaps. Yet instead, there I was, trotting like a fool through the mire and the quickening dark. Mine was an unusual profession for a young woman. In Spancel Narrows, where I was born, there was a kind old bachelor named Samuel Frost, who loved hosting his colored neighbors. Many a night we brought our suppers down to his estate, dined at his great table, and then sat at the hearth, listening to the old-timers. And for years, 3 mornings every week, my mother would hurry me along through the woods, and I would join Frost in his study while she cooked and cleaned. There I left behind the paltry education of the crowded schoolhouse, and under his careful tutelage, I learned properly to read, write, and tally accounts. I didn't realize until many years later, until I got to Dunmore, in fact, what a gift he and my mother had given me. His teaching gave me sovereignty in my work. My employer, Arabella, would be off for days to her meetings and speaking engagements with the true bands and the congregations as far off as Toronto, as far off as New York, even. After a while, it was decided I would stay at the house. There were 5 others there when Arabella was gone. Her brother worked days in the swamp, and he had 3 young children to whom he had the will, if not the time, to attend. The children's mother had not survived their escape. Their grandmother Valora used to look after the young ones, but she had begun to lose her hold on memory. She took to hiding food in corners and under loose floorboards, and dinner wouldn't be made when the brother came home from the swamp and the children from school. They would smell the food days later when it began to rot, and the children would hold their noses at one another and titter about Granny stinkers. Arabella would quell any such teasing if she heard it. She understood that Valora's forgotten caches were the resurfacing of an old practice. As a young slave woman, she'd made a habit of secreting away meat and provisions for her family in the field. As Arabella will often remind me, she considered me sent from above, even though my arrival in Dunmore was thought to be strange, for I came from the north when all others came southerly. Stranger still that I could read and write better than most men, colored or white. "I asked the Lord for a man and he gave me a hand," she would say and wink. So it was that I came to tend the Brimmer household. And when Arabella returned from sojourning, her shoulders struggling to remain upright, we would spend hours by the fire, talking low beneath the snores of the household and the meandering footsteps of Valora. We'd crush mint in jars of the tavern moonshine, and Arabella would recline on her chair and rub the heels of her hands into her temples and burrow her fingers into her hair. She would speak quietly, hushed musings interrupted by her chuckles and sighs. I would listen. I considered these soft ramblings the addenda to her notes detailing the struggles of fugitives, the battles of abolitionists, and the news from lands near and far. And after a while, invariably, she would give me a look, half grimace, half weary smile. "It's no easy task," she would say. "No easy task to show the world our worth." I listened and I wrote. The next day I would look to my scribbles and I would write again. When I was done, I would send my parcel to the editor in Windsor to be compiled with the articles from other contributors. And the following week, we would see the newspaper in the store, or better, clutched in the hands of men and women squinting beneath caps and brightly hued head wraps, spelling out words as they learned to be free men. By Arabella's account, sales for the Colored Canadian began as a pittance, like most small newspapers. It seemed unlikely that the Endeavor would survive. But by the time I arrived in Dunmore, the paper was becoming increasingly profitable. Whether this was due to donations from wealthy abolitionists or to the swelling ranks of fugitives eager to read, I did not inquire, nor did I care. She had enough to pay me well. Enough, too, to give generously to the true band of the church, which served as Dunmore's hub for the Underground Railroad. She never flaunted this generosity, but it was known, and she was adored for it. At true band events, new and old arrivals to Dunmore were reminded of that special miracle whereby a slave with nothing in the world could become a man with a house, food for the winter, and work. There was always work hewing and digging in the swamp, and as a government contract, this earned a man more money in a month than he had seen in his life, and for labor that wasn't half as grueling as what he was used to. What a feeling, to work in free country, to move to the harmonizing rumble and trill of voices, and to see faces unified in the sweat and toil, not of terror, but of purpose. So it was my lot as Arabella's hand that we came to need each other. She labored tediously over writing. She worried too much about how her words would sound once read aloud, and whether people would think what she meant for them to think. I, on the other hand, did not have the virtue to care what people thought, nor the will to ask. That was Arabella's gift. She had the touch, the softening of the brow that said, "I know what you have lived, and your words are sacred to me." Her high African cheekbones reminded folk of every slave woman who had ever inspired a dream of dignity in them. I, on the other hand, with my applewood skin, saucy tongue, and warring glares, tended to inspire at best a vengeful desire, and at worst, fragile condescension. All this was fine by me. I didn't think much of zeal, for I had never seen it last. I was content to be the unchurched, high yellow girl who tends the Brimmer house, and no one quite knows where she comes from, though all know what is implied in that lack of knowledge. But she is there, and Arabella is probably looking out for the poor bush wild thing. And so I minded my household tasks. I would cook and clean until I could not put off the writing any longer, and then I would take up my station in the study. Additionally, not as a general practice, but as peculiar occasion would have it, I would be called upon to heal. Mostly this meant preparing poke salad for a child in need of deworming, or a brew of scouring rush for old folk who complained of weak bones. There were several women and men in Dunmore who were root doctors with knowledge of potions as well as poisons, so I was not overly unique. But few solicited me openly, for although Dunmore was known as the witch town, it tried awfully hard not to be. Here and there I tended more serious wounds. I had once reset and splinted the broken leg of a child who suffered a kick from a mule. Twice I had stitched the cut wounds of drunken men who had brawled out
Sample complete. Ready to continue?